Good morning. You're listening to WGBH's Morning Edition. It's Thursday morning, 10 minutes before 9. And yes, he's here. Arts editor Jared Bowen joins me, as he does every week. Good morning, Jared.
Good morning, Bob.
Well, we're beginning this morning talking about Carita Kent. And she's a familiar name for anyone who's seen the famous gas tank along the Southeast Expressway.
Yeah, this is a very interesting story because Carita Kent was a nun at a religious order out in Los Angeles in the 1960s, and she was captivated by pop art, by people like Roy Lichtenstein, Jasper Johns, people she actually sought out in Los Angeles, tracking down the work of Andy Warhol. And so she was a teacher at the art department where she participated in her religious order. And so she explored Los Angeles for branding and packaging, and she would send her students out and about. And so what the Harvard Art Museums is doing right now in Carita Kent and the Language of Pop, an exhibition on view through January 3rd, is taking a fresh look at her and the fact that Carita Kent does belong in the pop pantheon of all these great artists. And I spoke with Jennifer Quick, a Harvard photography fellow who helped curate this exhibition, who told me about how the pop art scene in Los Angeles, which was basically second to New York, so very, very major, how that resonated with Sister Carita Kent.
There's this great story where one of her students talks about her piling them all in the car and driving around and looking at billboards. She just really believed that to understand the world around us and to interact with it, we have to be looking at those things, the things that are accessible to everyone, the things that make up modern life. So street signs, Wonder Bread, Campbell's soup cans. She saw those things as things that everyone knew and understood, and it was important to her to make art that was accessible.
I had no idea that she had this admiration of pop art or knowledge about it.
Well, it was a knowledge and an idea that she used to convey religious ideas. And this was the same time as Vatican II, where the church was changing its ways of teaching. It wanted, in part, to make a more accessible language. And she thought, well, what better way to do this? What better way, especially to reach youth than things they already know, like potato chip packaging. And so she would take these images, she would make these great screen prints, tilt them, make them fun with day-glow colors, and then she would incorporate text from everybody from the Pope to the Beatles. Oh. So she was spreading these messages. It could be incendiary. She likened the Virgin Mary to tomatoes. If they could be juicy, so could the Virgin Mary. And eventually, and I spoke with Jennifer Quick as well about how she looked at art in light of Vatican II.
She was very supportive of the church's goals of modernizing, using vernacular language, of rethinking the role of the institution in the modern world. Her work uses the language of pop art, essentially, to comment on Vatican II and vice versa. What's also important is that she held to orthodox doctrines of the Catholic Church. But for her, again, it was about communicating those in a way that made sense to people and seemed relevant in a world in which there was protest and war and mass culture. How do we deal with those things as the church? Maybe art can be a way to do that, and she certainly believed that.
Fascinating.
But it did come to an end. She eventually left her order. She moved here to Boston, and as you alluded to in the introduction, we certainly know Carita Kent by the big gas tank that she designed see on the Southeast Expressway. And that's where she really left her mark, her legacy. It's a rainbow swash is how she considered it. And, of course, there's still myths about whether or not you can find Ho Chi Minh in the blue streak.
There. And didn't they try to, like, paint it over one time and, like, the Citgo sign, Boston came to life and said, no way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So her legacy endures. But it's really an interesting story. And when you see her work in the Harvard Art Museums juxtaposed with all those other pop artists, you can't help but really believe, yes, she did belong there. She should have been talked about this entire
Fascinating
time.
Fascinating personality. Really. Okay. Next, we turn to what's on view at the Addison Gallery of American Art.
This is another great show, another favorite of mine. We're rich this fall, I think, with these terrific art shows that tell these fantastic stories. Converging Lines, Eva Hess and Sol LeWitt is a show, the first of its kind, just like Carita Kent, that looks at the relationship between these two artists. Eva Hess was somebody, first of all, they met in the 1950s in the downtown New York scene. They're both young artists, although he was about 8 years older than she, and she was she loved the abstract expressionist, so her work was filled with emotion, whereas with Sol LeWitt, he was a minimalist, very rigidly drawn lines, not a lot of emotion in terms of what he brought to his prints, and yet they formed this friendship. He was quite attracted to her. It was never reciprocated romantically, but they formed this friendship where he continued to inspire her. And I spoke with the Addison Gallery director, Judith Dolkart, about the substance of this friendship.
I think it was that they were complements in many ways. They're, on the one hand, their artistic production seems divergent, and yet they had some similar ideas in mind, and I think they just had an incredible mutual understanding between them about what they were after.
So he very much took an older brother role with her, and throughout her career, he would send her letters urging her to have conviction about her work, not listen to the critics, to just create. You can see these letters in the gallery. He would send her these fantastic postcards with wonderful images, again, to inspire her. And then it takes a very unfortunate turn. When she was 34 years old, she died of a brain tumor. And that was a pivotal point for him. He was actually in Paris at the time, installing an exhibition. He created Wall Drawing Number 46. And it's the first time you see him really depart from those rigid lines that I was talking about. Suddenly you see these wavy lines. You see more of his hand, just like Ava Hess created. Wow. So this show looks at how she had a long-lasting influence on the rest of his now very legendary career.
Wow, fascinating. That's at the Addison Gallery. Then we have a South African theater troupe returning to Boston with a Shakespearean piece.
Yes, Midsummer Night's Dream is playing at the Cutler Majestic Theater through November 21st. It's actually in repertory with another piece they're doing, You Carmen. But the one I saw was Midsummer Night's Dream. It's presented by Arts Emerson, and it's by the South African Isango Ensemble. And this is a group that's very, very interesting. They've taken the 1960 Benjamin Britten opera of Midsummer Night's Dream, which of course is Shakespeare's story about Oberon, the king of the fairies, teaming up with Puck to create mischief among lovers and his own wife. But what Isango Ensemble does is they look at the works of the Western canon, like these Shakespearean works, and they change the context, and they put them in the context of a South African township or South African folklore. So you see the story that I think many people just simply know the story of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, but it's told through this prism of a South African story. So you have a raked stage, marimbas lining each side playing, and you have some elements of folklore that spring that coalesce with Shakespeare. It's a very fascinating piece to watch, and it begins with some South African languages spoken. There are no surtitles, but again, if you know Shakespeare, you can absolutely follow along. You get this very vivid style of story making. It's so different and very, very fun.
All right, and then if you're headed to the theaters tomorrow, The Night Before?
The Night Before. Well, this is kind of a guilty pleasure. I love this time of year for the holiday movie entries.
The Night Before Christmas.
This one is kind of insane. Santa's bag, it's a mixed bag, unfortunately. You have three young men who gather. It's their tradition to gather every night the night before Christmas to celebrate because one of them, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, had become orphaned at one point. So you have Seth Rogen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Anthony Mackie gathering every night. They decide this is going to be their last time going out. They want to go out with a blast to find the Nutcracker Ball, this party they could never get into. Ultimately, it becomes sort of the hangover of holiday movies. It's very, very crass, kind of just disturbing, not necessarily the mix of the holidays that you would want.
Okay, and tomorrow night, Open Studio on WGBH2 at 8:30.
We just talked about Carita Kent. You can see her work as we look at the Carita Kent and the Language of Pop. And I'll talk to artist Percy Frotini-Wright, who has a new show at Babson. He's a graffiti artist by way of John Singer Sargent.
Wow, okay. Jared Bowen joins me Thursday mornings here on Morning Edition, our arts editor here at WGBH. Thank you so much, Jared.
Thanks, Bob.